Testing 1, 2, 3. Okay. Good to see everybody. Good to be here, and I appreciate the invitation. And it's been a long time. I held a meeting here, I think 2001 or two, somewhere way back when. And so it's been 12, 13, 14 years. And then prior to that, it's been a really long time. But I was 5 years old sitting on these pews all the way till I was 10 years old. And we moved away from Pinole in 1969. But I went to grammar school here. And Shannon School, I don't know if it's still around, but enjoyed my younger days tumbling around in the hills here. And it's great to be back. Ernie said that there was a desire to get some fundamental basic lessons about the gospel. And so that's what I aim to do this week. We live in a challenging time. I don't have to tell you that. For people of faith, people of the book, there are many, many challenges in contemporary society. It seems that our society is going completely the wrong direction, and we're trying to toe the line in the fundamentals of the revealed faith of the Bible. And more so, we face challenges of even communicating what we believe, why we believe it, to a world that is in large part skeptical of the very truths that we hold dear. And so I put a great deal of thought over the years into how to communicate the message in such a way so that people will listen to it, to pull them in closer to the truth of the Bible and the heart of God, and to try to eliminate barriers to a fair hearing of the message. And one of the things that I've used over the years with some degree of success is this little book of Ecclesiastes tucked right in the middle of your Old Testaments. And so if you have an Old Testament handy, a Bible with you, turn with me to the book of Ecclesiastes. I believe that part of handling accurately the word of truth is knowing how to use the sword of the Spirit to penetrate the deep recesses where the soul and spirit are divided, where joints and marrow meet, and where the thoughts and intentions of the heart are discerned. And the Lord has given us a powerful tool in Ecclesiastes. I kind of like to look at the 66 books of the Bible as pieces of a giant jigsaw puzzle, where every piece presents a different part of the puzzle, different part of the picture of the overall plan of God that He's revealed in the Word. And we need to know how to use these various books. Ecclesiastes is so universal. It speaks to everybody, regardless of background, and doesn't necessarily assume an assumed heritage of respect for biblical authority. I've taught the book of Ecclesiastes to agnostics, to atheists, to people of various kinds of faith, and almost always with good success. And so, ironically, Philip Yancey talks about not many sermons getting preached on the book of Ecclesiastes. I'm going to skip through here. Not many sermons get preached on Ecclesiastes, for it is one of the Bible's most confusing books. Many conservative Christians treat it with polite distaste, as if it had sneaked into the canon when no one was looking. Well, I have a much greater respect for Ecclesiastes and the Bible as a whole than that. But it is a difficult world we're living in, as I've already suggested. A remarkable thing happened 18 years ago in Fremont, California. A 17-year-old girl named Karen Ching, who had scored a perfect 1600 on both sections of her SAT test and a perfect 8000 on the Tufts University of California Acceptance Index, straight-A student at Mission San Jose High School in Fremont. No one in history had ever gotten a perfect score on both of those tests before. She was the first one. It may have been done since, I don't know. But brilliant, one-of-a-kind, straight-A student. But the national news story picked up on one more little facet of that. When a reporter asked this brilliant young lady, what is the meaning of life? She replied, I have no idea. I'd like to know myself. Well, that was 18 years ago, and we have gone even further down the gutter since then. And as I analyze my neighborhood and look around, I see people that don't have a clue, don't know why they're here. They get up in the morning, they go to bed at night, but they have no idea. How do we communicate the gospel to those people? I think we need to have a clue about how to do that. I used to use way back when the Jewel Miller Tex Stevens film strip series and other tools to help me teach people, but as good as those materials are and were in their time especially, they assume a shared heritage of respect for authority of the Bible that for the most part is no longer there. So we've got to go back and start at a point of agreement and build from there. Where do we start? I think Ecclesiastes is a really good point at which to start. And so you might look at this lesson as an evangelistic suggestion. That this might be something that you could use in sharing the gospel with a friend, at least on the front end of the process. I want to put the best bait on my evangelistic hook that I can possibly find. Ecclesiastes is tailor-made for communicating to people in our society and pulling them closer to take a fair-minded look at the Bible as a whole, especially the gospel of Jesus Christ. But I first want to just look at how the book's message is communicated, because one of the things that I've looked at in my years as a Christian and as a gospel preacher is not only what is communicated in the Bible, the content of the message, but how it's communicated. And every rocket needs a rocket launching technology to get it off the ground. And every medicine needs a means through which to get to the body. And so there are different delivery systems available. And God has used different delivery systems, if you will, in the different types of literature found in the Bible. And so some people have called Ecclesiastes protest literature. We normally talk about it as being part of the wisdom literature, the poetry sections of the Old Testament. Philip Yancey calls Solomon the first existentialist, and a Hindu, a former Hindu who had become a Christian, once told me the book of Ecclesiastes reminds him of the so-called sacred book of the Hindu faith, the Bhagavad Gita, because you've got all these cycles of life. He said the one difference is in the Gita, the cycles continue indefinitely and they don't have any conclusion, but at least you've got a conclusion, the end of the matter, in Ecclesiastes chapter 12. I thought that was insightful on his part. But you have a journey of experience here. And the answer to why we exist in Ecclesiastes is found more through firsthand experience than through a burst of special revelation, as if God's saying in chapter 1 of Ecclesiastes, boom, here's why you exist. Now we've got to wait till chapter 12 before we really get to the end of the matter, the conclusion, when all has been heard. So in many respects, Ecclesiastes, you know, we're privileged to go on a grand search through the eyes of one who had the wherewithal that we don't. Ecclesiastes, I think, is the most inductively reasoned book in the Bible because Solomon goes through all of these, all these doors. Is the answer to why we exist behind door number one? Well, no. Well, how about door number two? No. Door number three? No. And so wisdom largely comes through observation of why we exist and canceling out all the alternatives that don't work. Obviously, divine revelation is at work here. This is the end of the matter when all has been heard. Fear God and keep His commandments. This is the whole duty of man. But getting there requires searching through all the alternatives. And so God is permitting Solomon, and through him us as well, to see from an experiential standpoint that the historic pursuits of mankind are nothing but dead-end streets. The answer ultimately points to divine revelation, but the path getting there is indirect, if you will. And in the process of canceling out all the alternatives, Ecclesiastes is a negative preparation for the gospel, because it shows that all the historic pursuits of mankind don't work. And the only thing that is left is what God put there all along. Fear God and keep His commandments. This is the only thing that makes sense after everything else has been exhausted. You've also got in Ecclesiastes some wild oscillations of thought. You've got in chapter 2, for example, life is good. God put you here to enjoy life and to this life that He's given you and all the good that is found in it. And then he reverses and you say, well, life is bad. There's nothing good here. And then life is good. And then life is bad. And then life is good. And the way that I look at that is the author is either schizophrenic or he's inviting us to experience the process of discovery with him. That until you get to chapter 12, this is the end of the matter, all has been hurt, you're not there yet. And if you're not there yet, you're still in the midst of a journey. It's kind of like, it's kind of like being in the middle of a maze where you're trying to get to the end. And before you get to the end, you've got all these different possible turns, twists and turns. Well, that's how Ecclesiastes is, until you get to chapter 12. This is the end of the matter, all has been heard, fear God and keep His commandments. And so it's an invitation to experience the process where you've got 15 sections that basically say life is good, 13 sections that basically say life isn't so hot after all. And you've got that tension until you get to the very end. This is the meaning of life, to fear God and keep His commandments. So with that in mind, let's look at three sections of Ecclesiastes, and then the lesson will be yours. We're going to look at chapter 1, chapter 2, and chapter 12. I've done this with non-Christians over the last 20, 25 years, and haven't converted everybody, but I've converted a whole lot of them. I use this on the front end of my evangelistic teaching of the gospel to pull people in and to teach them the Bible is there's more there than they think there is. And I like to give illustrations. One illustration is from Francis Crick, the famous scientist, who together with James Watson discovered the structure of DNA back in 1953. But toward the end of his life, in 1994, he wrote a book, The Astonishing Hypothesis, The Scientific Search for the Soul. And in that book, he says, you, your joys and your sorrows, your sense of personal identity and free will are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. And I'm going, that's ridiculous. We know intuitively there's got to be more to us than that. But Ecclesiastes forces the issue. Read it with me, verses 1 through 11. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All the streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be done. What has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see this, it is new, it has already been here in the ages before us? There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. Well, what's he saying here? First of all, he says, vanity of vanities, it's all vanity. And the word translated vanity comes from a Hebrew word that could be translated vapor. Vapor, vapor, our whole existence in life is vapor. Puff of smoke, it's here today, gone tomorrow, and not much to it. Life is so brief, so short. And is there any substance to it above and beyond a vapor? So he asks the question in verse 3, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? Another way of asking that question is, at the end of the day, when everything is said and done, have we accomplished anything? Why are we here? What is our purpose in life? And the interesting thing about that is he gives three illustrations from nature. The rising and the setting of the sun, verse 5. The swirling of the wind, verse 6. The evaporation cycle, verse 7. All of which are designed to show that life is like an endless racetrack. We are like hamsters in a cage on that little circular thing that they run on without really getting anywhere. We're going around endlessly in a racetrack. But are we getting anywhere? Are we accomplishing anything of lasting value? Or are we just here? You get up in the morning, you take a shower, you fight traffic, you go to work, you go home at night, you put your head on the pillow at night, and what do you do the next day? Same old, same old. Same thing. And we go through life like that. Then there are cycles of life. You know, you grow up. You finally get an education, you get a career, get married maybe, have kids, you start getting older, you advance in your career, you achieve certain things in life, but you start getting older, and you pass the torch to the next generation, and what do? Same thing. And there's a certain monotony to that after a while. The thrills that once were so exciting are not so exciting anymore. I was in Minnesota the last few days visiting a couple of little grandkids, and I've got a three-year-old pistol of a granddaughter that red hair, and the family had to go to Indiana. As they were taking me to the airport, they were on their way from Minnesota to Indiana to go to a funeral, and my daughter was explaining to her little three-year-old daughter, we've got to drive all day long to Indiana. And the granddaughter's saying, how exciting! And my daughter's saying she doesn't have a clue. That's an intergenerational difference there. But we get to the point where it's how exciting at the beginning of the process, and then we start saying, okay, they don't have a clue. Been there, done that, experienced that. There are television scenarios, drama, you know, TV shows that used to excite me. Then I've got the plot all figured out now. Okay, been there, done that. Doesn't do for me what it once did. Are you relating to this? If you're a certain age, and life is like that, where we get to passing the torch to the next generation, but we've done that before, and. And so then you get to verse 9, what has been is what will be, what has been done is what will be done. There's nothing new. And then verse 11, there's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. Here's a question I ask, especially non-Christians, when we study this. Do you know who your great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents were? And genealogy buffs aside, nobody does. I mean, once in a blue moon, there's, you know, somebody. But, okay, if you don't know who your great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents were, why is that? Why don't you know that? And the answer, you know, it's not really relevant to the life that I'm living now. I'm busy in my life, and they were busy in theirs, and I really don't care, and that's the key. Don't really care. That information is probably available. You can search online. There are genealogy tools available to find out that information. But the reason, bottom line, is we're just not wrapped up in those generations. They're gone. And if that's the case, what are the chances that your great, 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 great grandchildren will know who you are? Let aside, you know, laying aside any consideration of what you've accomplished, will they even know who you were? Will they even be able to name your name? And chances are not very good that they will have a clue. Then what are we doing here? Just passing the torch to the next generation so they do the same thing over again. They'll pass the torch to the next generation. And that's Solomon's point here. There's got to be something more fundamentally satisfying about living life here. At the end of everything, when all is said and done, that we've accomplished, that makes life more fundamentally important than that. And so Solomon in chapter 2 says, basically, I'm going to beat the system. I'm going to insert into the formula some thrill, some adventure, something, some accomplishment that will make my life more than just monotony all over again. Chapter 2, verse 1. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works, I built houses, I planted vineyards for myself, I made myself gardens and parks, I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdoms remain with me. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this was my reward for all my toil. Thus I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil that I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. And so, he tries to break the cycle and to insert into the equation some cheap thrill, some accomplishment, maybe some grandiose attempt. With a drive of a type A personality, the author tries to break that endless cycle by embarking on a grand search for happiness. And Solomon had it all. He had fame, power, money, women. You read 1 Kings, for example, and sometimes I do this when I teach this. According to the end of 1 Kings 4, he wrote 3,000 Proverbs, 1,005 songs. He had chariots. He had horsemen. He built the temple in Jerusalem. He built his own palaces in Jerusalem that took almost twice as long as the temple. And the temple was magnificent. He had 700 wives and 300 concubines, according to chapter 11 of 1 Kings. In 1 Kings 10, the Queen of Sheba comes, and she said, I've heard of your fame and the hearing of the ear, but now I've seen all this with my eyes, I've experienced it, and behold, the half has not been told. Here's a man who had it all, fame, power, money, women. Unfortunately, his frame of reference is rather selfish. You look at the personal and reflexive pronouns of verses 4 through 8. I built this for myself. I did that for myself. I did this for myself. I accomplished that for myself. It was me, myself, and I. And look at all he had done. Archaeologists still refer to the Solomonic Gates of Giza. He has an archaeological gate type named after him. The temple would have been one of the wonders of the ancient world. People everywhere came to hear of the wisdom of Solomon. He's a man who literally, you would think, has everything. And the way I personalize that to people today is with this simple fill-in-the-blank exercise. If I only had blank, then I'd be happy. What's the number one answer? Money. If I only had $1 million, well, maybe in the Bay Area, if I only had $5 million, make it $10 million for good measure, then I'd be happy. Would you? Is everybody that has $1 million happy? No. A lot of people have $1 million around here, and they're just miserable. Howard Hughes had many millions of dollars, and he said, I would trade it all for one happy marriage. So let's take the money away and add the wife. Are all married people happy? There are a lot of miserable married people getting divorces left and right. Oh, but if we just had kids, can't stand the spouse, but if we just add some kids, then my life would be complete. Are all parents happy? No. Man, got to deal with these kids. And we've got this little place in which to live. And if we just had a kind of a bigger place, put the kids on one side of the house and us on the other side of the house, and a bigger vehicle to you know, transport them to the soccer field, the SUV, are all SUV and bigger property owners happy? No. These mortgage payments are killing me, and the economy is lousy. But if I only had that advancement in my career, then I'd be able to pay for all this stuff. Are all people who climb the corporate ladder happy? This work is killing me. 24/7. If I only had that retirement package, then I'd be happy. Are all retired people happy? Well, there comes a point at which retired people say, my body's falling apart. And it's not what it used to be. Oh, to be 20 again. It seems like we go through life and we're chasing blanks. If I only had blank, then I'd be happy. If your happiness depends upon a blank, you're not living life the right way. If I only had blank, then. Here was a man who had it all. He didn't have a deluxe SUV, but he had deluxe chariot. And he had palace. And he had building projects, and he had monuments, and he had work, and he had fame, and he had power. He had prestige. He had women. He had fun. He had it all, right? Or wrong? Thus I had considered all that my hands had done and the toil that I had expended doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. And I want to tell you something. Everybody in this Bay Area can relate to that if we explain that to them. I don't care what their religious background is or isn't. Everybody I've studied this with gets it. There's got to be something more. Something more fundamental than this rat race. So when I've got them in the palm of my hand, then I turn to the end of chapter 11 as a segue into chapter 12. In verse 8, so if a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all, but let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. All that comes is vanity. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these things God will bring you into judgment. Remove vexation from your heart and put away pain from your body, for youth and the dawn of life are vanity. In other words, you're young only for a very, very short time. Go ahead and chase your dreams. While you're still young, chase your dreams. Dream big. But remember that whatever direction your life goes is fair game for judgment, because God will bring all of this into judgment. With all that in mind, he says, and this is an unfortunate chapter division, verse 1 of chapter 12, remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come, and the years draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. In other words, there's a day coming when you're no longer going to be young. You're not going to have the energy you used to have. You're not going to have the health that you used to have. You're not going to have the vitality that you used to have. You're not going to have the endless number of years that you used to assume. So when is the time to remember God? Now, when you're still young. When you've got your whole life ahead of you, when you've got years of service in keeping with the purpose for which you were put on this earth, don't wait till you get old. Start now, when you're young. Because a day is coming when you won't be young anymore. And through a series of images, ancient metaphors, figures of speech, he describes the aging process, and it's not pretty. In verse 2, before the sun, the light, and the moon, and the stars are darkened, and the clouds return after the rain. I've been in some really thick and heavy thunderstorms. I was doing a gospel meeting one time when in the New Orleans area, Hurricane Ivan was coming in, and New Orleans evacuated. This is right before Katrina. And then Jeff Carr drove me across the Lake Mandeville to the airport, and New Orleans was a ghost town. At the time, we were living in the Birmingham, Alabama area, and so I flew. I got onto an airplane, flew from New Orleans to Birmingham. And in the meantime, Ivan had done a kind of a switcheroo. And it came up through the panhandle and up right up into Alabama. And we got it in Birmingham. And rain was going sideways. And we had, it actually came into the rafters of the home, and we had buckets in our dining room. We had bubbles coming out of the ceiling, and just it was the biggest rain that I've ever experienced, I think. But the next day was absolutely beautiful, a sunshiny day. And that's how it is when you undergo a terrible rainstorm. You always assume the next day is going to be bright and sunshiny and beautiful. It was just incredible, beautiful day. But have you ever experienced a terrible thunderstorm, and then there's another one, and then another one, and then another one, and then another one? And verse 2 here says that you've got the darkening of the heavenly bodies, the moon, the stars, the sun, and then you have this rain, and then what happens the next day? Clouds return after the rain. We actually lived in Oregon for a couple of years, and one winter we had 33 straight days of rain. That messes with you, because you have rain one day and you want sunshine the next day. It doesn't happen. Rain, and then rain, and then more rain, and then more. 33 straight days of rain. Well, that's what it's like to get to a certain point in the aging process. You have this terrible rainy day, and tomorrow's going to be sunshiny, right? And it doesn't get any better. And the day after that, it's going to get better, and it doesn't get any better. and then the day after that, and the day after that. And instead of going uphill, it goes downhill. That's what he's saying here. That the sunshiny days are few and far between. Verse 3, in the day when the keepers of the house tremble, you've seen an older person with Parkinson's or just becoming weak by infirmity of age, and the trembling of the body. The strong men are bent. We have a sister in Christ in Santa Clara who can't straighten up her back, and she walks around like this. Just recently went into a nursing home, but she can't. Osteoporosis has wiped out her posture. The strong men are bent. The grinders cease because they are few. Your teeth go. And those who look through the windows are dimmed. Your eyesight isn't what it once was. I used to have this 20/20 vision that was just amazing, probably up until the time that I was about 40 years old. And I'd wake up in the morning and open my eyes, and it was a little bit blurry, and I'd do this, and it was as clear as a bell. And then finally, it hit me that I'd wake up and things were blurry, and I'd do this, and it was still blurry. And I did this, and it was still blurry, and then I put these on, and what have I been missing? Because the eyes are not what they once were. Verse 4 says, the doors on the street are shut when the sound of the grinding mill is low. The grinding mill was the place of hustle and bustle, of activity. The harvest season, they would bring the crops in from harvest, and they'd thresh the grain from the chaff and all of that, and turn the grain into flour. And it was like a harvest festival. Everyone who was anybody would be there, except for older folks who were kind of pushed out or through voluntary retirement were not a part of that anymore. And so the doors on the street are shut, and one rises up at the sound of a bird, and all the daughters of song sing softly or are brought low. Your hearing goes, maybe easily startled, wake up early, but you can't hear anything to enjoy it. Then verse 5, they are also afraid of high places, and terrors are in the way. Older folks don't want to take that long journey. It's too much work. Don't want to drive at night. Don't want to get out. Just want to stay home. And you get to that point in life where you don't want to undertake an expedition or an adventure like you used to when you were young. And then the almond tree blossoms. Almond trees turn white. And you got the graying of the hair. And then the grasshopper drags itself along. Grasshoppers are not meant to drag, although at the end of the life cycle, you see grasshoppers drag. But after we disperse, you'll have the little kids kind of running around and full of energy, and you have older people just kind of dragging. And you wish you could bottle that energy from the little kids and give it to the older folks. Amen. And desire fails. That's literally sexual desire. Some of your translations will say the caperberry is ineffective. That's an aphrodisiac. We live in a day in which you've got the television commercials about certain additives and prescription medicines that make parts work. And I'm not going to go into all those details, but the point is that there comes a point in life when no additive in the world works anymore, because the body is falling apart, because man is going to his eternal home and the mourners go about the streets. That's a funeral scene. Before the silver cord is snapped or the golden bowl is broken or the pitcher is shattered at the fountain or the wheel broken at the cistern, and the dust returns to the earth as it was and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, it's all vanity. Imagine a gold-plated piece of pottery in an ancient Israelite home, and someone knocks it over, and you've got 100 pieces. Can you just pick all the pieces up, glue it back together, and pretend you've got the same pot all over again? No. Nor can you turn back the clock once you're 80 years old, be 20. It's not doable. You've got one chance. This is a probationary period. Life on earth, you've got one chance to get it right. One chance. That's it. And we grow old, we breathe a few breaths, we're a year older, 5 years older, 10 years older, 20 years older. And we get to think, my, how fast the time has gone by. Why, it seems just yesterday that I was a little kid sitting on this front row. But I know it was a half century ago. Seems like yesterday, but it's gone. That period of time is gone forever. And we've got one chance to get this right. So verses 13 and 14 says, with all that in mind, the end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every hidden thing, whether good or evil. Childhood and the prime of life are fleeting. You're going to get old fast. The compelling conclusion, fear God, keep His commandments. This is why we're here. This is why we were put on earth. But how many people operate with that assumption in mind? If you were to do a survey around your neighborhood, why do you think you're here? What's our purpose in life? Do you think the number one answer would be fear God and keep His commandments? I know that's why I'm here. I want to wrap my whole life around that twin purpose. Very few people would say that. But here's what we need to tell them. And this, you know, after I'd done this hundreds of times, this finally hit me like a ton of lead. And an unbeliever helped me to understand this. Carl Sagan, he was a famous scientist, did the PBS specials on the cosmos before the current Cosmos show was resurrected on Fox. But way back when, he wrote a book called Cosmos. And the first sentence in that book said, the cosmos is all that is, or was, or ever will be. I prefer the first sentence of another book that says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Amen. And he died an agnostic, Carl Sagan did. But toward the end of his life, he wrote another book called Pale Blue Dot. It was about the Voyager 2 spacecraft being projected into space billions and billions of miles, taking shots of Earth and sending those pictures of Earth back to Earth in the midst of the vast expanse of space. And the farther the spacecraft got away from Earth, the smaller Earth was, until it was finally nothing but a pale blue dot in a universe so big we can't even wrap our minds around how big it really is. And on the first pages of that book, Pale Blue Dot, Mr. Sagan says, we think that what we're accomplishing on Earth is so important, but it's really not. All we are is ant-like creatures on a pale blue dot in a universe so big it staggers the imagination, and there's no one out there to save us from ourselves. And I want to tell you something in Ecclesiastes 12, 13, and 14. If you take God out of the picture, and if you take Judgment Day out of the equation, then Mr. Sagan is absolutely right. That's all we are. And most unbelievers have not thought about that long enough and hard enough. All you are is an ant on a pale blue dot, functioning without any purpose in life, leaving a legacy to the next generation, going through the motions in automatic pilot, in monotony, without any purpose. What's your life worth anyway? But if you put God back into the equation and you put Judgment Day back into the equation, then this life is a probationary period awaiting a day of judgment, a day in court with the Almighty, beyond which eternity hangs in the balance. Then in that scenario, every deed is important. Every word that comes out of your mouth is important. Every thought that you think is important. Your purpose in life is important. Fear God and keep His commandments. This is the whole duty of man. Now all of a sudden, your life is invested with tremendous worth and value. Which view of life fits better? Solomon forces us to think about the real issue here. And I believe our people all around this area need desperately to hear this message. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or evil. That's why we're here. And it's not a message to be ashamed of. It's the only thing that makes any sense if you come to really think about it. Can our lives be invested with purpose and meaning in the absence of accountability? The answer is absolutely no.
Thank you, Mike. We thank Mike for